The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So, good morning. It's nice to see all our local friends, plus all our retreat guests. We hope you've had a good retreat. This weekend, you certainly had good weather for it. The ceremony we did this morning is celebrating the Buddha's birth. Next month, we have another ceremony, which is called Vaisak, which celebrates his birth, his enlightenment, and his death, and his teaching all kind of rolled into one. And that's called Vaisak. And that's a worldwide celebration in all of Buddhism. This particular one comes out of our East Asian tradition, China, Korea, Japan, perhaps Himalayan countries, I don't know. But it is specifically about his birth. I'll just briefly go over the events around his birth. Some of you may already know. I know some of you already know. And the scriptures in the ceremony refer to, you know, some of the incidents, but I'll just go on and go over it for the sake of our retreat guests, so in case you don't know. The Buddha was born in a city-state, essentially, in at that time, India, which was like 16 different countries. There wasn't the nation of India that we think of today. And the name of the place was Kapilavastu. His father was the king or chief. When national boundaries were drawn, Kapilavastu ended up in Nepal, I think, rather than in India. But it's certainly still there, and it's become one of the main pilgrimage sites in Buddhism in India. One of the incidents that's told in the scriptures is about a white elephant coming in a dream that his mother had of a white elephant coming and entering entering her womb. And that's a way of indicating that he was a very special child. White elephants were, you know, like most albino animals, very rare. And so in India they had become indicative of a saint or holy, very holy person. So that's a way of indicating that. His mother was on her way to Devadeha, which was where her parents lived. She was the princess of a neighboring country, and it was common in those days for the woman, the mother, to go to her parents' home for the birth of a child. And she was on her way, and they stopped at a beautiful wayside park or garden called Lumbini Garden. And she began to have labor, and the Buddha was born in that place. When we have one of these ceremonies, one of the things we try to do is recreate the setting for the events described in the ceremony. So in this case, Lumbini Garden, you know, all these flowers and trees and everything. So on the altar, so then we set up, you know, all sorts of flowers, you know, to indicate that. Most of us will probably, well, I don't know most, but many of us won't ever make it to India. And I guess in East Asia, most people were not going to get to India. So in the ceremonies, they developed a way of going on a pilgrimage through the year, stopping at the various holy places in the Buddha's life. And this one represents Lumbini, the flowers. That's the baby Buddha, you know, standing there in Vaisak will be a fountain. We'll have water pouring over him. It said that the Buddha, and the first thing he did was take six steps and say, I alone am the world honored one. We'll talk about that in a little bit. but that's the story. They returned to the palace. As was common in those days, the king, his father, called in the astrologers, and seers to make a prediction about his birth. And most of them held up, two fingers saying, well, he could be a world ruler. Or if he wanted to, he could become a Buddha. And one of them held up only one finger. He said, no, he's going to be a Buddha. I think he's going to be a Buddha. And that actually becomes, that particular seer becomes one of the Buddha's first disciples later on, 35 years later. And we really don't hear much more about the life of the Buddha until his adolescence. He was raised as a warrior. He was in the warrior caste. And, was kind of very skilled at everything, archery, swordsmanship, whatever. He was really great. And then we find him a beautiful wife, and he marries and has a son. And then he awakens to the suffering of the world. Something was not quite enough. And that's another ceremony, so I won't go into that one. We'll just stick with the birth today. How do we look at stories like this? Do we take them to be literally true? Are they symbolic? Are they just someone's imagination, kind of trying to fill out some of the gaps in our knowledge? I think there's several different ways of looking at them, and that's what I will talk about today. Different ways of looking at events in the life of the Buddha, not just his birth, but I'll focus on the birth specifically. One thing that's kind of a historical aside, the litany that we did this morning, Litany of the Buddha's Birth, that comes from a book-length poem called The Light of Asia by Sir Edwin Arnold. He was a Victorian journalist, and he wrote this, long poem, and it was, from what I understand, probably the first biography of the Buddha in English-speaking countries. And since England ruled most of the world, that was most of the world. One of the good things that came out of the British occupation of India was that the British were always very curious and very scholarly about places that they adopted into their empire. And so archaeologists started trying to trace the history of India. At the time, in India, people just thought the Buddha was a legend. There was no record, there was hardly any sign of his life at all. In the Hindu tradition, they considered him to be an avatar of Vishnu, some kind of celestial embodiment of one of the Indian gods. But one of the archaeologists kind of got, well, there were several, but they got going on, well, maybe these places do exist. And so they took the Chinese pilgrims' records. A number of the Chinese made pilgrimages to India in the, 7th, 8th, 9th century in order to get the scriptures and bring them back to China. But they wrote, detailed records. And by following these records, they were able to find these various sites that are mentioned in the Buddhist scriptures related to the Buddha's birth. And so now, you can go to India and you can go to the major sites in the Buddha's life. There's all sorts of other places, related that you can go. It's just something that didn't exist 100, 150 years ago. So it's very interesting. But Sir Edwin Arnold was the first who, in a way, made Buddhism known, you know, in the English-speaking countries. I don't know for sure, but you know, it's a likelihood, perhaps, that this is how Reverend Master Jiu came into knowing about the Buddha. Her father had a big library as a child. She was reading, you know, would read books in the library. He was a Buddhist, and I suspect this was one of the books that was in his library, because she very early on as a child found a connection to Buddhism and considered herself a Buddhist there as a child. So in some ways, Sir Edwin Arnold can be considered an ancestor of ours. You know, not in our direct lineage, but he was one of the people who helped us be where we are now. And I always, when we use some of his works in our ceremonies, I always think of it with gratitude, you know, because he did something that made possible the transmission of Buddhism to the West, okay? And something very beautiful as well as actually accurate in terms of the teaching. He was actually quite accurate in terms of how he presented the Buddha's life and the teaching of the Buddha. So how do we look at these stories? How do we look at, sometimes they're called legends? Several ways. The first way is to simply try to suspend judgment and just have an open mind. Okay? Just be open to the possibility of that these things may have happened. That's the mind of meditation. Okay? It's not critical. It's just open. Perhaps, perhaps not. Okay? But don't shut down. Don't shut down any possibilities, right? This is the way that I found our founder, Reverend Master Jiu, to teach us these things, at least in my day. She never made any, we didn't really ever talk about these things much. We just, you know, this is what Buddhists do, and so we do it. You know, there was never any hesitation about incorporating, you know, the Buddhist stories into our liturgy and in transmitting them over from Japan, you know, into the West. There's more to our minds than our critical, you know, analytical mind. There's other ways of knowing than through empirical knowledge. As Westerners, we're actually prejudiced as a result of the science, and sometimes called scientific materialism. You know, we only believe what we can see. You know, we only believe what we have proof of. But there's other ways of knowing, and we want to stay open to that, because meditation is going to take us in that direction. There's a Zen saying, you learn to see, hear with the eyes and see with the ears. Okay, there's the mind of meditation, which contains things that we can't prove by our senses, but something in us knows, intuitive. Now, this isn't, you know, specific to Buddhism. I think all, you know, world religions point us to that. Call it spiritual, call it mystical, call it what you want. But there's other ways of knowing. And these stories have, if you will, kind of an embedded meaning in them. Okay? And so it's good to take them on faith. Now take them on trust and just suspend the judgmental mind. Here's a couple examples from the Buddha's birth. Well, I already mentioned one, you know, the white elephant entering his mother's womb. Okay. That's indicating, oh, this is really special. You know, he's a very special, going to be a very special child. Then, you know, when he, you know, at birth, you know, stood up and took seven steps. Well, how are we supposed to take that? It said that the seven steps represent the seven stages of the Buddha's teaching. I don't know what those are, and I haven't been able to find that out yet. I'm sure it's in some book someplace, but I look at it as he was the he was the seventh Buddha. When we do the ancestral line in the morning, and we do the lineage, and we recite all the names of the Buddhas and ancestors, we actually start with Buddhas, okay? And Shakyamuni is the seventh, even before, you know, Shakyamuni is the Buddha of this world, you know, historical, but there's Buddhas before him, okay? And one of the things that's valuable to keep in mind is the Buddha didn't consider himself to have invented something new. Okay? He was rediscovering what was true. Okay? And so he was in a line of succession of Buddhas in other worlds, you know, whatever, but he was the one for this world who rediscovered the truth, you know, and spread it throughout, eventually throughout the world. He, you know, also said, you know, he stood up and, like the statue, the little statue, one finger to heaven, one finger to earth, and said, "I alone am the world-honored one. In heaven and earth, I'm the one." That can sound kind of egotistical, I think, for us as modern Westerners. But what that's pointing to is that there was an awareness there that this life was going to be important. Okay, he was going to make the best use of his life, and it would benefit beings. Again, you know, kind of, we really don't hear much more about that until he, you know, renounces the world and becomes a Buddha. It's very much. Now, I'll come back to that point, but just hold that. So, these various stories, we just keep an open mind. Okay? There may be something that they're teaching us that, you know, isn't part of the analytical mind or the empirical, you know, critical mind. Maybe something's being expressed or taught us in a way that you know, our, you know, empirical scientific minds just can't grasp. Okay. The second way of looking at these stories is to see Shakyamuni's life as a model for our life. You know, he was born. He was a human being. Okay. And like us, he was born with, if you will, born into purity, you know, Buddha nature. And that's one of the things that, you know, this ceremony and others are pointing to, is that we're all born pure. Okay? We're not born into, you know, original sin. If you will, we're actually born into original purity. Okay? And the life of the Buddha and the story, the way he's born and things that happen, are pointing to that. And just as it was true for him, it's true for us. We're all born into what one of our monks calls, if I can remember right, I'm sure I can get the right words for this. It'll come back to me. But anyway, we're born into a state of non-duality. The child, you know, at birth, will put anything in its mouth because it doesn't understand the difference between other and self. See? And at some point along the way, you know, teachers and parents and so forth have to teach the child that you're different. There's an inside and an outside. All right? And some people describe that as quite a wrenching, you know, being wrenched from one's original purity. Some people can actually, you know, find that spot in their lives through meditation. Her Master Jiyu talked about this, and she said it usually happens around the age of 7. But she said, you know, in our modern world, things keep getting up, so it starts earlier and earlier, probably in our modern day. She also taught us that some kids make it through. Now, some kids make it through this pull on them from, you know, the people around them, and kind of keep that purity intact. She also said they're usually looked at as a bit odd. You know, they have a really tough time. I can remember, I grew up in the South, and there were kids in our school, you know, high school, that were, I think they were Pentecostal. I don't know. I think that was it. They were very quiet. You know, they very rarely participated in class. They certainly didn't, you know, go out for sports. They were just very, very quiet, and there was a purity there. You know, looking back on it, I can recognize that. They were, somehow or another, they had kind of kept that purity intact, and they were able to withdraw enough into that in the setting that wasn't disrupted. Yeah. So for me, at least, that's, you know, in my own life, I can see, you know, proof of that. You know, that some kids make it through. Some kids may, you know, maintain this, you know, purity. But most of us, we get kind of wrenched apart. Okay. And that's just normal. It's not a bad thing. It's just what happens. Okay, in order for us to survive in the world. The incident with, I'll just take a couple other examples. One is, you know, being born in Lumiti Gardens, you know, beautiful place. It said all nature rejoiced. Okay. Likewise, when we're born, you know, the universe rejoices. Okay. We may not feel very happy when we're born. Okay. You know, usually they, you know, spank us on the behind and get us to cry. But for at least a moment there, there's a unity with all things. Okay, there's a unity with the universe. And, as I was saying, we usually lose that. And then eventually, again, we come back trying to find that. The Buddha had everything anyone could want. You know, he had a harem. That's usually not mentioned. He had a harem. You know, beautiful women. He had several palaces. He had anything he could want. You know, his parents were actually trying to keep him from seeing the suffering of the world because they wanted him to be a great king. You know, they were like, you know, probably our parents. They had expectations. Okay, again, this is the way that the Buddha's life, you know, parallels our own. You know, the parents had expectations of what they wanted him to do, so they were trying to set things up so that he would do that. But he encountered suffering. Okay, something didn't quite satisfy. And so in a series of trips outside the palace, he encountered an old person, a sick person, a dead person. He encountered suffering. And what really struck him was that not only was this true for everyone, but it was true for himself and for the people he loved. And he said, I don't have an answer to this. You know, I don't know how to alleviate the suffering of the people that I love. And out of that came the motivation to go in search of the Dharma. The fourth, what's called the divine messenger, was he saw a renunciate. And he saw someone who was training, someone who was meditating, someone who had kind of stepped outside the conventional society. And that gave him the inspiration, there is an answer. I don't know what that person has, but that's what I want. Okay? And that happens with us as well. Okay? We all come here because we're looking for something. We may not know what we're looking for, but something brings us here. Okay? Something opens us up. We've encountered some kind of suffering, sometimes, or sometimes we just know there's something more. And we come and we look and try to find. Again, it's a parallel to the life of the Buddha. And like the Buddha, the Buddha had several teachers before he, kind of found the middle way, found the best way to train. And that's like us too. Okay, we look, we search. Sometimes it takes a long time. Sometimes it takes a number of teachers, to go through and not find quite the right one. But again, in the Buddha's life, he finally found that. And for him, it was the merit of his life that he could find it within himself. Okay? And we can find it within ourselves too. He eventually had to become his own teacher because he went to the best people he knew and couldn't. He got as far as they did, and they were saying, "Well, why don't you take over?" And you know as much as me now, so why don't you take over? The Buddha said, "No, I don't think this is quite it." So he finds the truth in himself, and that's the same with us. We meditate. We meditate in order to find this truth for ourselves. Okay? It's within us. Okay, it can be found. It exists. Okay, and we find it by looking within, and by meditating. And then we find it along the way. We may not, realize full enlightenment, but there's a fruit that comes from training, okay? And that's, again, kind of parallels the Buddha's life and the Buddha's enlightenment, okay? Maybe we just touch a little peace and joy, but we touch it. Okay? We come to know, there is something more, and that gives us the faith to continue. That's the second way of looking at the Buddha's life and these stories, is to see that it's a model for us. It's a teaching to us. A third way is to just say, well, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter, because what remains true is what the Buddha taught. Even if all these stories are just legends, even if he had never lived, okay, what he taught was true, and we can prove that truth for ourselves. Okay, in that case, the stories become, they're nice stories. There's beautiful music, and can we just kind of appreciate that and enjoy it? But the principal reason we do these things, are there ceremonies, or we come together to train in a monastery, we sit at home, whatever part of the practice we take up, we're trying to prove the teaching true for ourselves. And that's what the Buddha says. Don't take my word for it. Prove it true for yourself. Okay. And we can focus on that. We actually need to remember that, and not get too caught up in kind of some of the externals sometimes. Okay. We'll prove it's true for ourselves, and no one can do it for us. Okay. We have to do it ourselves. And one of the really useful things that Reverend Master Jiu taught us was what she called the back burner method. Okay? She would often use cooking metaphors. All right? know, we have this whole body of teaching in Buddhism. How do we relate to that? How do we go about proving that true for ourselves? And what she taught us is that we start with faith. Okay? We start with trust that there's something here. And we act on that. We act on what we know. And the rest of it we put on the back burner. Okay? Sometimes I think we put it in the deep freeze. You know, but we at least put it on the back burner and we cook on what we can there on the front burner. All right? And every once in a while we open up the back burner pot and stir it a little bit and see if, you know, okay, are we ready to pull this to the front? No, I don't think so, not quite yet. And sometimes I think there's a lot of kind of backing and forthing. Okay. So we work with what we do know and what we can accept and then build on that. Although faith and trust is essential in practice, and just sitting looking at a wall is an act of faith. It's an act of trust. Why are we doing that? It seems, you know, what do you get out of looking at a wall? But we practice what we can, okay? And then, you know, make sure you're putting effort into that front burner, and then you can build on that and learn other things. Although, as I said, although faith and trust is essential, it's not blind belief. There's not a creed that we ascribe to as Buddhists. Okay, there are the precepts. We take the precepts because they're helpful, you know, to our training. They show us how to live an enlightened life. At one point, many people formally take the precepts. That's sort of an external commitment to doing the practice. But again, it's not a set of beliefs so much as it's a way to live, as a way to practice. So those are, you know, some thoughts on how to look at the Buddha's birth, other events in his life. There's a deeper teaching perhaps going on that, you know, that's really teaching our heart. It's teaching in a deeper place. There's a model for our own life, okay? And then there's, well, it doesn't matter, but the teaching is true, and that's what's important. That's what we pass on. That's what makes our life different. Okay, that's what gives us the strength and courage to go on. I want to close with a little story from... it's called The Water Babies. It's something that River Master Ju, you know, gave to us. It's a Victorian fairy tale, essentially. It's a father teaching his son about life, you know, and the important things to learn. And he's sort of making it up as he goes along. And the story goes that there's a, you know, a little chimney sweep named Tom. Okay, he drowns. And he gets reborn in the ocean as a water baby. Okay, then started off in the ocean. He actually starts in the creek where he drowned. But the gist of the story is that while he was a water baby, there were lessons that he needed to learn. You know, learning about compassion, gratitude, all the things that we try to instill in ourselves. You know, I don't know that if the man was a Buddhist, the author was a Buddhist or not. I don't know, but there's Buddhist teaching kind of woven through that. And then he gets reborn, you know, and he gets reborn clean, you know, in a better life, and he gets born in such a way that he can, you know, go and court the little girl, you know, that he had. Was always in love with, because he had changed himself enough, he had transformed himself enough that he would be reborn and go ahead. You know, better life, better than being a chimney sweep. It's a lovely story. There's a lot of satire in it too. You think it's a children's story, but then the way it's written, there's, you know, the father's making fun of, you know, quack medicine and various ologies and you know, politics and all these other things. So you kind of, you know, so I don't think it's just for kids. But at the end, what he says is that, you know, remember, you know, that this is all a fairy tale and fun and pretense. And therefore, you are not to believe a word of it, even if it is true. So we'll close with that in three homages. Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all of the Bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.